In Neil Burke's debut novel, Line, a huge mass of people live for years, generations even, in an enormous queue that spans hundreds, possibly thousands of miles. Theirs is a completely controlled existence ruled by fear. Although set in a dystopian future, the concerns of the novel are very much current. Free market capitalism, surveillance capitalism, data mining, property speculation and the migrant crisis. Neil Burke joins me now from London. None of us like a queue, that's for sure, Neil. But Line really does take this to quite an extreme. It was a queue that inspired you, in fact, or was the initial inspiration for the novel?
There was a Ray Bradbury kind of writing quote, and he said, "Oh, if you're looking for something to write about, just, you know, come up with a list of 10 things you hate and like tear them down." And when I came up with my list, I think queuing was at the top of them. I just can't stand it, so I just... It was kind of a thought experiment to see what would be the longest conceivable queue that would get me to stand in it, and, you know, why would it keep me there? And it kind of went on from there, I suppose.
Yeah, because I don't know if you heard earlier, we could hear the programme from London. We were talking earlier about the Louvre and, in fact, about the Mona Lisa. Now, if you ever went to the Louvre, you have to queue quite a long time to get to see the Mona Lisa. It was a trip to Venice that was a queue in Venice that was the beginnings of this novel.
Well, probably one of many, yeah. But there was we're queuing for the Doge's Palace, and like it's a key tourist attraction, so unsurprisingly there was a very big queue, and I was just like, I just can't be bothered, I'm on holidays, like, I'd rather sit down and have a coffee and watch people in the queue. I'm sure it's nice in there, but like it's almost as if you felt you had to go stand in the queue for 4 hours because it was something on the holiday list that you had to take off.
Right, you just didn't want that. Well, you've taken your revenge on your poor characters in this novel then by having them queue for the... Well, we won't go too far into how much and how long they're queuing. But anyway, let's talk about Willard and Nyla in particular, have been in the line their whole lives. Tell us a bit about them and who they are and the life that they've spent in this line of the novel's title.
Yeah, I guess to some degree they're an every man and every woman. And they're kind of beholden to keep their place in the queue by tradition, because their place has been given to them by their parents and their parents before their parents. And it's just not kind of socially acceptable to renege your place because you can't be bothered waiting, because you carry the weight of tradition and history kind of on your back. And they've all been in the queue so long they've forgotten what's at the top of it. It's kind of turned into a myth about, you know, what's at the top. But they know it must be pretty good, because why else would they be there so long?
And skipping the queue is not a good idea.
No, that's the central tenet, thou shalt not skip the queue. Because there needs to be some mechanism to keep order in what could very easily, as anyone who stood in a kind of ramshackle queue knows, could descend into disorder if someone starts skipping ahead. I think there's a sense that, you know, if you think you're playing by the rules in a queue, but someone else then isn't, that causes great umbrage, I think.
Yeah, but what you do to those who choose to skip the queue, as the author of this book, is pretty nasty stuff. the dripping red catastrophe. You might explain.
Yeah. So if you're caught skipping the queue, you kind of go through a kind of ritualized flaying, where as everyone kind of passes you on the line, they take it in turns to take like a strip of your skin off. And when I was doing my research, actually, I found out there was a Chinese punishment called a Ling Chi, maybe, I might have the name wrong, which was a kind of a similar social punishment. And the idea was that no one person was responsible. So if everyone inflicts the wound, then no one person is responsible for killing the perpetrator, and therefore the kind of guilt is shared across the community. And so it's a kind of similar sense of ritual shared out punishment to keep a sense of order in the line.
Now, there are a few parallels that struck me. I know that the author Ronan Hessian described Line, your novel, as the grapes of wrath for the digital age.
Yeah.
You know, and there is that sense of it in some ways, not quite going across the Dust Bowl, but this big, you know, this big mass movement of people, wherever they're going and wherever they're coming from, there is a sense of that period. Are you making some kind of parallels there, or is it just history repeating itself in terms of economics?
It's probably history repeating itself. Like, obviously, I am aware of Steinbeck, but I think maybe, you know, the plight of, you know, the disenfranchised working people probably doesn't change that much from generation to generation. The Dust Bowl was quite extreme, but, you know, the idea that there's a large section of people who are kind of forgotten about and forced to traipse around, you know, trying to scrape a living together, probably, you know, that probably doesn't change that much, I suppose.
And the other, I mean, that imagery is there in the book, or certainly was there in the book for me. The other imagery that is there, I think, undoubtedly, is that of refugee camps. Were they on your mind in any way when you were writing the novel?
Yeah, because it took me a long time to write the novel. It probably took about 5 years. And as I was writing it, you know, things on the news were kind of filtering into me and then kind of obliquely filtering into the novel. So, you know, you had the Syrian refugee crisis, and then you had everything with, you know, the elections and Brexit and Facebook and data, and all that was kind of, you know, it was kind of filtering in through me and kind of in through my ears and kind of drifting down through my fingers and working its way into the novel, almost unbeknownst to me, I suppose.
And you have a background in economics. You studied economics for a period of time, Neil. How do you think that has fed into the book? Because particularly in the latter part of the book, I don't want to give too much away in terms of plot, but the kind of ideas that you're discussing, it really is taking free market capitalism and it goes into a crazy, crazy place. What were you looking at there?
I was trying to write, I suppose, instead of sci-fi, like economics fi, like economics gone mad. Kind of, you know, what Jonathan Swift did with The Modest Proposal. He kind of took a, you know, a utilitarian premise, and he kind of extrapolated it out to its absurd degree. And I was trying to do something similar, because when I studied economics, there was a rule or a saying that they had, ceteris paribus, which was all else being equal. So, you know, you look at a demand curve or supply curve, and it would say, ceteris paribus, this will happen. But of course, there is no ceteris paribus, because everything isn't always equal. And basically, ceteris paribus was, we don't really know. And it kind of struck me that economics was parading itself as a empirical science, but it was kind of made up. And I was like, sure, if they can make it up, I can make it up. So I suppose that's what I was trying to do, invent my own kind of take on economics.
But like, things do get to a ridiculous stage or state, I suppose, in terms of where our two characters, Willard and Nyla, and others from the queue and the line, they find themselves in a world that has literally been turned upside down. But to what extent do you think, you know, you push free market capitalism to the very limits in terms of the society that exists in the line? Is that the direct, in truth, do you feel that is the direction that in some ways Western society is heading?
Well, it's obviously an absurd exaggeration, but I think we've seen that if markets are just allowed solely to regulate themselves and no one at any point steps in for anything, like, things don't end very well. We've seen that with the 2008 financial crash, and we're seeing it with the environment. So I think, again, it was kind of a thought experiment. And yeah, I've pushed it to like a fairly absurd place. But, you know, if we just leave things totally to themselves and let the market sort it out, then where will we end up?
In fact, you know, I think you, at the time you were writing Line, you were reading 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. This is the Ha Jun Chang.
Very good.
And I suppose one of the things that is within that book is this idea that there is no such thing, in fact, as a free market. You can't, it always has to be interfered with.
Yeah, that was his point. And he was like, look, if you're advocating for a free market, you're deluding yourself, because a free market means you have to allow slavery, child labour, like everything. The minute you make any kind of regulation, the market is regulated. So when you're advocating for a free market, what a lot of people are really advocating for is something regulated in their favour.
Yeah.
And he pokes a lot of holes in that. He doesn't throw capitalism out with the bathwater and say, get rid of it totally. But I think he asks legitimate questions. I suppose maybe I was quite stirred by that kind of, the way he pointed it out was very clear, it was very obvious. I was surprised. I'd never considered it before.
And in some ways, then, are you trying to give us a fictional version of that? Is that what the line in ultimately is about?
Yeah, I think economics is definitely at the heart of it. You know, economics kind of is often accepted as, you know, an empirical science that can make accurate predictions. And I don't think it works like that. And I think if we put too much credence into economics as a, you know, as something as infallible as physics and the laws of gravity, then I think we're setting ourselves up for problems. So I think we should tweak its nose from time to time.
Right, and that's what you're doing in the novel. And the poetry was also there in your background. You had great success with an initial story which was shortlisted for the Costa Short Story Award, and then Real Problems getting published after that. was poetry yeah, kind of a, like, did you go off on a side trip towards poetry and then eventually come back to the novel, or what way did that work, Neil?
No, I still write poetry. I kind of write them side by side. I have something coming out, a choose your own poetry adventure coming out in 2022. Because poetry suits me in some ways, because I can write at least a draft of a poem in a relatively short space of time, whereas a novel, you know, it takes years. But the short story, that was the second thing I ever wrote. I got shortlisted for the Costa Short Story Award, and I was like, oh, geez, this writing lark is easy. And I didn't see another thing published for about 3 years, so kind of brought me back down to earth, which was no bad thing.
Yeah, well, the novel is there now, and thanks for speaking to us about it this evening, Neil. That's Neil Burke there, and Neil speaking to us about his novel Line, which is published by Tramp Press. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio.